for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. President Bill Clinton once called Kashmir the most dangerous place in the world. It's also been called one of the most beautiful. In a new book, Kashmiri journalist Basharat Peer talks about how his countrymen survived being trapped between two nuclear-armed rivals. He also explains why he has hope for Kashmir's future. The book is titled Curfewed Night, and Basharat Peer joins me in the studio. He's a journalist who's written for The Guardian, Financial Times, and Foreign Affairs. He's currently a fellow at the Open Society Institute and a native of Kashmir. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Basharat, good morning and welcome.
Thank you for having me on the show.
It's my pleasure. Talk about the situation in Kashmir today. I know you were on the phone with colleagues this morning.
I was talking to my family just this morning, and Kashmir is under, has been under curfew for the last 7 days, and it's a curfew in an extreme form. It's a most militarized place in the world. It's a larger number of soldiers than any other population you can imagine. There's 500,000 Indian soldiers in the Kashmir region. And this so it doesn't really make it to the news here, but it has been in this state of fear and tension constantly, I mean, almost for the last 20 years, but the last 2 years have been particularly bad. And this particular incident was after two schoolboys were shot by Indian troops, and there were popular protests against that. And then, as a measure to curb the protests, the whole place has been locked down.
So the title of your book, Curfew Night, is particularly relevant now.
A lot of friends back in Kashmir joke that I should write a sequel called Curfew Days. Mm. But it was a metaphor. It really comes from a poem by this great Kashmiri American poet who taught at Amherst called Agha Shahid Ali. There was a time when nobody heard of Kashmir, when there was no news that came from Kashmir. And he has this beautiful poem where he talks about Srinagar, the main city in Kashmir, and says, "A city from where no news came is now visible in its curfewed night." And it was an image that just I had grown up with. I mean, it sort of summoned up the impossibilities and longings about just an evening walk, the impossibility of an evening walk. I haven't taken an evening walk except for in New York when I moved here to the States. But in Kashmir, it was simply just after sunset, you could not step out. It was just too dangerous. And that's how it has been for the past 20 years, this constant fear.
Tell us about these eighth grade boys who were killed. Why?
There are various reports. I mean, there was an altercation in one case that, you know, there's frequent checkpoints. There are checkpoints everywhere, and it was said that there was an altercation at some point where, at some place, these boys were playing cricket and a convoy of a military convoy was nearby, and there's some argument which led to the firing. There's also, I mean, it's only illustrative of something. The problem, it's a bigger problem there, is this unlimited power that is vested in the troops deployed there. It's unlike American troops deployed elsewhere who could be, you know, charged in a court of law and prosecuted if it's proven that they did something in Afghanistan and Iraq. But instead, India has this set of laws called the Armed Forces Special Powers Act, which essentially gives complete immunity from prosecution to a soldier if he suspects somebody to be of threat. He's empowered by the law to shoot that person and won't be prosecuted in a court. There has been a big moment for repealing those laws. There have been like hundreds of protests, civil rights groups, Indian intellectuals and writers have spoken about it. And even the Indian government of late has been talking about the necessity to repeal those laws and to move the troops from residential areas, but we still haven't seen any progress on that.
Bisharat Peer, his new book all about Kashmir is titled Curfewed Night, One Kashmiri Journalist's Frontline Account of Life, Love, and War in His Homeland. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also join us on Facebook and Twitter. You talk about your childhood in a chapter you call Fragile Fairyland, 1977. Talk about your childhood in Kashmir.
Well, the book begins with that line. I was born in winter in Kashmir, in a small village in southern Kashmir, and it is indeed very beautiful, and it was a very quiet, peaceful world on the way to various treks. I mean, you sort of grew up watching people from all parts of the world pass by my house because there was only one road that went by and we lived by the road. And you'd see all these people in these buses and no idea where they were from really, but, you know, Western tourists, Indian tourists, strange looking people to the eyes of a child sitting by a window. And that's how life went. And then, you know, my father worked in the local government, and he would come home with these books, and that was one big event in my life. Was every weekend, father would come back with these books, and you know, abridged classics, Charles Dickens, Stevenson, you know, a little bit of Hemingway, and we would sit and read. And he was big into poetry, and then he would just recite, you know, Tennyson or quote from Shakespeare or the great Urdu poets, Ghalib and Iqbal or Fez. And he would say, I would give you 2 rupees if you can explain what this means. And that's how most weekends went. Huh. Dad reciting these poems and me and my younger brother trying to, you know, make more money by explaining what this particular line from Shakespeare or from Tennyson or from Keats meant. But there was also this context, which I understood later. It was the struggle of a self-made man who was aware of living in a very volatile political context to educate his children so that, because he knew that was our only chance.
To get out?
To make anything of our lives. And by the time I got to high school, it was very, very evident. I was in 89. I was just, I think, 8th grade, vaguely. So that was when, just in 87, there had been these big elections for local government in Kashmir, and you could see the fervor. It was very charged, and there was the two parties, the ruling party and the party which ran Indian National Congress. They were in an alliance, and then there was this whole coalition of opposition groups, and It was very likely that the ruling parties would win, but they just ensured they rigged the elections and arrested the opposition candidates, and they were tortured in prisons. And there was this feeling of, you know, there's no democratic space or political rights that would be available to Kashmiri people like this. And a lot of those political activists, the original agreement with India was an autonomous Kashmir with minimal Indian control, but over the years that had been eroded, and sort of puppet regimes from Delhi were ruling Kashmir. And this loose coalition of opposition parties was in a way a challenge to that erosion of autonomy. But now these guys were put in prison, and a lot of them, whom I interviewed later as a journalist, told me that it was in the prisons that they decided, as young men, as young political activists, that they would pick up arms and start an armed rebellion against Indian rule in Kashmir. And that's what we saw in the winter of 1989. Just, I was back home for winter holidays from school, and just, you know, another of those sessions was going on, reading a book, talking to my father about something. And suddenly there was this upheaval. Everyone was talking about the boys. It was this Kashmiri nationalist group called Kashmir Liberation Front. And, I mean, nobody had actually seen a gun in my neighborhood. I don't remember, you know, when a man was killed in our area. It was this quiet, you know. But with the serious political context of India-Pakistan rivalry, the three wars between India and Pakistan over Kashmir, and then these boys decide to fire their first shots against India. And they had kidnapped the daughter of India's interior minister, who was a Kashmiri as well at that time, and demanded the release of some of their friends from prisons. And what happened next was surprising to everyone. It just seemed that it was that repression, that lava that had been dominant for 20 years, that just exploded. And millions of people came out on the streets. And things really got bad in that winter with those protests being crushed and a cycle of violence continuing ever since.
Basharat Peer. The book is titled Curfewed Night, One Kashmiri Journalist's Frontline Account of Life in His Homeland. And welcome back. Basharat Peer is with me. He is a Kashmiri journalist who went back to his home after it had been really quite radically changed. When was the last time you were there, Basharat?
2 weeks back.
2 weeks back. And what did you see there?
It was... It's always sad going back, and it's always a joy going back. It was good to see old friends who are still around, and, you know, there's a engaging with the political situation in ways which are very interesting. People are working on novels, making films. I met a 21-year-old graphic novelist who loves Art Spiegelman and Joe Sacco, and there's some youngsters trying to make music. And there was this one small slice where it's this very intense intellectual engagement with how do we tell our stories. That has been the defining sort of question. There's this feeling that, you know, our stories haven't even been heard. And in some ways, that was a question that pushed me to write this book. There was always this feeling of, there's so much that happened in Kashmir that we need to talk about and tell the world. And so that's something I did see there, that, you know, that we have Kashmiri, young Kashmiri educated people are moving towards telling their stories.
Basharat, when you were 13 years old, you thought you might join the militants because you were frustrated. You felt you wanted to take up arms.
Yes, I did. I was 13. It was the time when the massive popular rebellion against Indian rule had started, and people all around me were being killed. You know, peaceful demonstrations were being fired upon, and it was also a time in the world where new countries were being born, where freedom was being talked about everywhere. We watched on our small black and white TV sets the fall of the Berlin Wall. The Prague Revolution had happened. And every person you spoke to in Kashmir thought an independent country was possible. I really remember this moment sort of where I was talking to a friend, you know, about the new year and how it would be in a new country. And we really thought it would be possible in a month or two. We were naive and very heady. And at that moment, when every teenager was saying, we'll pick up arms, we'll fight the Indian Army, and we'll get our free country, I wanted to sign up too. So I actually talked to a couple of my friends, and we went to looking for local commanders of a guerrilla group near our school. And we met these young men who seemed the most charismatic men to us, in their green uniforms, you know, the military uniforms and small Kalashnikovs.
Were they Kashmiris?
Yeah, Kashmiris. They're all Kashmiris. Like people from our neighborhood, people we have known. So the moment I walk up to this commander and I say, we want to join you, he slaps me. And he's like, you're my teacher's grandson. My grandfather was a high school teacher, and he had taught almost everyone in that area. And he's like, you're a kid, go home and grow up. This is not for you. So that was sort of the end of my adventure. But
you wanted to do
it. I did want to join, but after that, too, I mean, I thought a bit about it, but my parents, my father, I mean, there was all the sort of high drama that comes with such situations at home, with my mother being all teary-eyed and my grandfather,
sure,
who was like, look at this old man and what are you thinking? And then my dad, who again came with this like set of books and gives them to me and says, if you want to do something for Kashmir, read.
The personal experiences that you had, you nearly lost your parents in 2001,
yeah,
to a mind blast. What happened there?
They were in a car coming from a wedding, and it's a small village. They had gone to see some, you know, a relative of ours was getting married, and there's this tiny road, and as my father told it, he said, I saw these two youngsters by the road holding something like a calculator in their hands or a television remote, and then the next thing you know is the car, There's an explosion, there's a landmine in the road, and the car goes up.
And with your mother and father
in it. And luckily, they survived. And it was an illustration of how when conflicts continue forever, they are used for reasons, you know, which are very different from the political reasons, the official political reasons of a conflict. In this case, it was a small-time local political operator whom I call Iago after Shakespeare's Iago, who played all sides, you know, that classic creature that grows up in a conflict. He would be with the Indians, play the Pakistanis, play the militant groups, play the armed forces, and also had political ambitions.
But do you think your mother and father were actually targeted?
They were.
They were?
Yeah.
Because?
Because my father worked in the local government, and this person whom I call Iago, he wanted him to do something that was illegal. And my father said, this is against the law. I wouldn't do this. And that man went on to convince a particular militant group whom he sheltered at various times, that this man is against your interests. And that's how, like, a rumor can kill a person there. And that's what happened. It was providence, physics, chance. My parents survived. But this has happened to many people.
And some of your father's friends.
Father's friends, my friends, relatives, neighbors. There's no family that hasn't lost someone.
How did you decide, or how did your parents decide, that you would get out?
Early 90s was, you know, I left Kashmir for the first time in 1993, late 1993, and that was a time when the conflict was at its more intense. So India had really cracked down upon the rebellion. Any boy who was 15 or 16, you know, there were like hundreds and thousands of soldiers on the roads, you would simply be picked up and arrested and tortured, and a lot of people just disappeared. You know, the Latin America dirty war techniques were used intensively in Kashmir. We have around 10,000 people who have disappeared after they were arrested by the troops, and there's no traces. Only recently, last winter, a local civil rights group found these mass graves near the border, and where hundreds of people, I visited there, met this man who has been burying those bodies, and he says, you know, the military bring them to the police and the police brings them here, and, you know, as I feel, that's what one should do for the dead. So that was the, you know, time in which I was a teenager, and every middle-class parent was, my son can be killed. So anyone who could afford, like mothers sold their jewelry to send kids out, even if they couldn't afford to. And they were like, you know, at least they will live. Doesn't matter where they go, what they study. That's how I got out.
And where were you sent?
I was sent to a college a couple of hours from Delhi. It's an old, you know, Muslim institution, university, which was sort of modeled on Oxford by the early sort of South Asian Muslim modernists. And it was a very interesting experience. They were culturally very different. It's North India. But just being living on your own for the first time, being in a big university, and while I arrived there, I also met Kashmiris from various other parts of Kashmir.
But at the same time, you had just come from an area where violence, you felt, was being perpetrated by Indian troops. Yes. And yet here you're going to a university, as you said, north
in
of
India.
Delhi. How did you feel about that?
There was no other way out. I mean, you live with the choices you can make. There was discomfort, there was suspicion. I mean, partly why I was sent to this particular university was they thought that it would be safer there, it would be easier. I mean, there are many other places in India where if you're seen as a young Kashmiri man, you'd be like a Chechen in Moscow. The police just goes after you. Scores of cases of, like, boys just being picked up and arrested and got...
But at this particular
university, I mean, partly because it's an old Muslim university which has a whole tradition of all kinds of people going there to study, my parents thought it would be easier for me. And it's also, you know, in their small lives, from a small village, this was Harvard for them. You know, that was Oxford and Cambridge. That's what they had heard about. This was like the big brand. And they were like, our son will go there, make something for himself. And it was very interesting to understand India while being in that place. Again, on the margins within India, because you're living in a minority institution. And it really helped me as a journalist later, that experience of being there, and helped me understand India better, to see it from an angular position rather than just going to the heart of the power in Delhi.
You talk primarily about Indian troops. What about Pakistani troops?
Pakistani troops, I mean, the big sin of Pakistan was, you know, after the early 90s, which was largely the Kashmiri guerrilla groups. They didn't want them. Pakistanis weren't happy with the Kashmiris talking about Kashmiri independence. So what they did was they propped up these Islamist groups, which were all for Pakistan, and pushed them into Kashmir. And on various occasions, they actually got the Kashmiri groups killed. And later on, in the late 90s, we saw the like most dramatic form, which continues even today, of these groups like Lashkar and Jaish. Lashkar was the group that's believed to be involved in the Bombay attacks last year. Now, they are all ethnic Punjabis from small towns in Pakistan, but they are the ones used by the Pakistani military to attack various targets in Kashmir and in India. So, I mean, Pakistan is equally responsible for, you know, destroying a lot of Kashmir.
Basharat Peer, his new book titled Curfew Night. We are going to open the phones, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Did leaving Kashmir help you to understand more clearly what was happening in your own homeland?
Yes, it did. I mean, I kept going back and leaving, but yes, for the first time when I left, just sitting in that university, sitting in a library, reading. I remember reading in college first year in Aligarh, the small university, reading George Orwell and his memoir of the Spanish War, Homage to Catalonia. And suddenly I knew what I had to do with my life. I could just, page after page, there are these echoes. He writes about the walls of Barcelona and I see Srinagar. He writes about a mountainside and I see Kashmir. And it was really through reading that book at that moment I knew that I have to train myself, teach myself how to write and try to tell the stories of Kashmiris. And then the process of reading further and being away from home and getting a sense of what's happening in the world. Yeah, leaving home did help a lot.
But what did you find when you then returned home? You tell the story of Shamima.
Yeah. It was also, I left and got an education, but there's also guilt. I was the, you know, middle-class kid who had the privilege to leave when hundreds and thousands couldn't. People who were much brighter than me but are dead today. And there were people who were in school with me. So I felt this need to go back and to talk about people, to write about the conflict in its barest forms. And Shamima was one of those people. There's a woman, the story of a woman in a small village. I mean, she's really one of the heroes of the book. And there's a gunfight between the army and the militants in a village near her own village. And her son, she has two sons, and this older son is just chatting with friends by the roadside. You know, it's like hanging out at the equivalent of a coffee shop, is more like any shop front. You just stand there and talk. And this military convoy comes and stops there, and they just charge at these boys, and these boys run, but they are picked up and taken to that place where the gunfight is on. And that has something that has happened a lot in Kashmir. We have even coined a term for it, just human shields. So while the fighting was going on, they actually gave one of the Shamima's son a landmine and sent him in to negotiate with the militants, to tell them to, you know, lay down the arms. And in the gunfire that ensued, he was killed. But then another son too had, you know, been taken by a group of soldiers there, and he was about to be pushed in when she heard the news. So she had like just ran through fields. That's how she told me the story. She said, I fought with everyone. And I went there, and they were pushing my second son in, and I jumped at the landmine. And I said, no, I will take it. You can't kill my second son. And then she brought him back. She used the phrase, she said, I got him back from the eagle's beak. And all the while we were talking, she just kept staring at me. It was strange. I was like, why? And it was in a very strange way that she kept looking at me, as if she knew me. And as I was leaving, she just hugged me, said, I have to tell you something. She said, the boy who was killed looked just like you.
Basharat Peer, his new book is titled Curfewed Night. He is a Kashmiri journalist talking about his homeland. When we come back, it's time to open the phones. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, providing schools that work, strategies for 21st century success. Learn more at edutopia.org. By the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. And by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, celebrating Black History Month and investing in strong futures for kids at aecf.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, the political battle over how to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and other alleged terrorists. We talk with Jane Mayer, who covers politics and national security for The New Yorker. Her current article, The Trial, is about how Attorney General Eric Holder's choice of a civilian trial for the architect of 9/11 has galvanized Republicans. Join us.
Welcome back. As I speak with Kashmiri journalist Basharat Peer, his brand new book is titled Curfewed Night. We'll open the phones now. Let's go first to Cincinnati, Ohio. Parkash, you're on the air.
Diane, thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I'm a long-time listener, first-time caller. Your guest has a very inspiring story, and just to give you a little bit of background, I actually grew up in India and immigrated to the States about 10 years ago. So a lot of the events that he was witnessing, I was watching on TV or listening on the radio while going to school in Delhi. And essentially, I want to make two points. One of them is your author presents a slightly hypocritical view, because although he feels that he was persecuted in Kashmir, he was able to obtain a very good education. I'm aware of Aligarh University. It's a very well-known and respected university across the world. He was able to obtain that education in a country as large as India, which essentially is a secular country of 1 billion and has the second largest Muslim population in the world. The second quick point I want to make is this whole notion that there was a populist revolt in Kashmir that started on its own, I think, is a misnomer. I think if you look back in history, there have been three wars with Pakistan over Kashmir, And the underlying theme has always been that Kashmir should belong to Pakistan, and there's always been a underlying push for a militancy to be created and to subvert the voices of the local people of Kashmir. That is my opinion as an Indian.
All right, sir. I'm glad you called.
Prakash, thanks for calling. And I guess our slightly different perspectives make the difference between living something, reporting something, and watching it on TV. I don't think it's a misnomer to call, you know, the rebellion in Kashmir a popular rebellion. That was what it was. Yes, I did talk earlier. If you seem to have neglected that there were wars between India and Pakistan, and Pakistan was always happy to fish in the troubled waters in Kashmir, and they did that very much. But no general in Pakistan could make a phone call and get hundreds and thousands of peoples on the streets in Kashmir, in the smallest villages where there wasn't even a radio. It was really about disaffection with India, about failures of Indian democratic system in Kashmir. And yes, it is, I feel very generous that I feel that India was very generous to allow me to study in a university. And I mean, I do owe that debt. I think, well, what can one say? Universities do let you enter if you qualify the criteria, and even if you are from Kashmir.
Let's go now to Roanoke, Virginia. Good morning, Deep. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. This is a great segue as a follow-up from Prakash's question. A couple of quick notes. My father is a physician intellectual who was sent by his father, who is a physician intellectual, to Utkar University as a Hindu to really understand the multi-ethnic melting pot that India truly is. Now, as a follow-up, I've actually been married into a Kashmiri family from the Hindu side, and they have been completely displaced by the militancy. They have lost their homes. They cannot visit Srinagar. They have no place to live within the country or within the state that they were born in, which is incorporated as a state within the country of India. The author seems to state that Kashmir is not part of India at all, and that he was a benefactor of the great university to allow him to enter India to study. He was Indian within Indian-controlled Kashmir, which is actually a state within. It's like saying Rhode Island is American-controlled Rhode Island. It doesn't make any. It's really a biased perspective that you're presenting.
Well, Rohan, that was an answer to what the earlier caller, I think Prakash, was saying, that I got an yes, I do carry an Indian passport, but it is a disputed territory. I mean, there's not a dispute between America and some other country over Rhode Island that America recognizes, while India does recognize a dispute over Kashmir. America hasn't fought three wars over Rhode Island. India has. There's no insurgency going on in Rhode Island for the last 20 years. I think that makes the difference. And yes, I mean, about an important point I do want to make, and which I was hopefully later in the show going to read from, is the question of, you know, the Kashmiri Hindu minority. I have spent time with them and done interviews, and they were my friends and very close neighbors. And the section I had chosen from my book was to read from a visit to a camp where you know, the pundits live. And yes, I mean, that was one of the most tragic things in the Kashmir insurgency, is that various prominent pundits were assassinated, which created a wave of fear among the minority. And they left for the southern part of the state of Jammu and Kashmir, called Jammu, and to various towns and cities in India. And no, it's one of the saddest things I've seen in Kashmir, is going to those camps and meeting friends of my father's and my neighbors, and knowing that, you know, they had to leave. It's a burden every Kashmiri deals with. But, and it's an important part of the story.
All right, let's go now to Pro Tip in Huntington, West Virginia. Good morning, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
I sort of agree with the previous two callers. I'm from India also. And I feel this book is not, he's not a journalist. He has presented a very strong religious point of view. I wondered, I mean, if he had to go to India to study, why didn't he go to a non-Muslim university? Aligarh Muslim University is known for its religious influence. I think he would have been better served to go to some non-Muslim, you know, regular secular university. And why doesn't he talk about ISI and the Pakistani influence? And how about the area called Pakistan-controlled Kashmir? I think it's called Azad Kashmir. I think this book is very biased. It's religion-based. And I feel, Diane, you did a wrong choice in even discussing this book. I'm sorry to say that. Thank
well,
you.
Pro tip, you know, many, many books come through our office, at least 250 books a week. And indeed, I chose this book because we have not had on this program before a Kashmiri journalist. I'm sorry you disagree with my choice. However, I think it's an important point of view to hear. Would you read for us, Basharat?
Thanks, Jan. Despite the accusations, which were expected because there's a very big, extremely right-wing Hindu contingent in India, which is very aggressive about the media. So despite all that, this is about a visit to a small camp where in Jammu, it's like a refugee camp where some of the Kashmiri Hindus were living, and an encounter there. I walked around trying to locate the people from my part of Kashmir. A 50-something man in white kurta pajamas appeared out of a narrow lane. I asked him if he knew anyone from Anantnag. He looked at me carefully. Are you from there? Yes, I replied. Where in Anantnag? From Sir, I said. Sir was the name of my village. You're from Sir. Whose son are you? I gave my father's and grandfather's name. His eyes lit up. He laughed, swore at me fondly, hugged me. Before I could ask him who he was, he grabbed my arm and told me to keep my mouth shut and follow him. We walked through the dirty, cramped lanes running between rows of camp houses. He stopped outside a shabby hut where a frail woman was washing clothes. Get up, Gauri, he said. Hug him. He's your son. She didn't recognize me, and we reluctantly hugged. She's your father's sister, Avatar told me. I stood there, completely perplexed. My father never had a sister. I was stunned when the woman said, is he Amul's son? Amul was my father's childhood nickname, which hardly anyone outside the family knew. She looked at me again, held me in her arms and cried. We walked into their one-room hut. A bed took up most of the space in the room. In a corner was a tiny kitchenette. We talked for hours about Kashmir and our lives there before the conflict. Gauri talked about traveling with my father back and forth every day to a job in a village far away. Her parents were worried about her traveling there again. They allowed me to join there only after they knew your father would take me along, she said. On the walls hung clothes and pictures of Shiva, Rama, Krishna and Saraswati. I was about to leave when a young girl walked in almost unnoticed. She had Gauri's face and Avatar's black eyes. We were introduced. I made small talk. The girl turned to her mother with a pleading glance. Gauri asked Avatar and me to take a walk outside. The girl had to change. She was 13. There was no other room. There were no prospects of a bigger house in sight for them, and the girl was growing up. How long could she sleep on a mattress on the floor besides the bed her parents occupied? What meaning would words like drawing room, study, bedroom, or balcony have for her? How would she relate to stories of people living in houses? Maybe her parents would try to explain. They once lived in a house that had rooms.
Bashar, why didn't you know that your father had a sister?
No, she's not a biological sister, but they were neighbors. Like, my father's family and this Hindu family lived next door, and they're very good family friends. So, I mean, yeah, so she called him a brother, and that's how it's their old friendship, this sort of, the old affections that continue to live on despite rhetoric.
And the Hindus then were sent to this camp?
A lot of them went to this camp. You know, there was fear. Kashmir was totally exploding. It's all in this context of, you know, after those firings on these protests and extreme militarization, nobody knew who was where. And in that time, there was a series of assassinations of various prominent pundits and also various prominent Muslims who supported India. And although the Muslims, pro-India Muslims, didn't migrate because they were still part of a large majority, the pundits were extremely insecure and scared, and they moved away to the other towns and cities.
Bashar Peer, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And let's go now to the Eastern Shore. Marf Margaret, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
Surely.
I'm looking forward to reading this book. Just a tiny bit of a background. In 1988, which I guess would be when your author was, I think he said, in high school.
Yeah.
I was the first woman to run the entire length of the Himalayas, 3,000 miles, starting in Darjeeling and ending in Kashmir at the golf course in Gulmarg, but going through Srinagar.
Wow, and that's quite a feat.
Yes, and when I was there, first of all, let me say that the best way to know a country or a people is to be there among them on your feet. And I was only there for 5 days total, but I will tell you that I loved that place. And I've listened to some of what has been said by some of the previous callers. Let me just say that your author is very correct in terms of the people coming out on the street, because in 1988, when I, on the last day of my run, I had to run nonstop from Srinagar uphill to Gulmarg, to the golf course, and going through Srinagar, I came upon one of those crowds being beaten back by Indian troops. And there was only me and my dog that I had brought with me on the whole run to see and to witness what was going on. The Indian troops were right there in the heart of Srinagar. At the same time, I will also say that this was, that last week of my run was when the premier of Pakistan was killed in the plane crash, along with the American ambassador. And there were a lot of Pakistani implications and forces that I was aware of in Kashmir at the time. And the biggest thing of all is that at the time, just before I came over the pass to come down into Srinagar and into the Kashmir Valley, of course, at that time, we didn't
know. Margaret, I'm afraid we're almost out of time.
You know, let me just say that it was Osama bin Laden. We didn't know who he was at the time, but he was there.
All right. Thanks for your call. She was quite a witness to history.
Yeah, no, to be able to walk or run in Kashmir, it's been an impossibility. I think she was the last person to have run like that through that place, unless you're running from a bullet.
Basharat Peer. His new book is titled Curfewed Night, One Kashmiri Journalist's Frontline Account of Life, Love, and War in His Homeland. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.